Welcome back to FinTechLa, the podcast from the National University of Singapore's FinTech Lab. I'm Jongpil Han, your host, and with me is...
Nicholas Garcia.
Yeah, it's been a while, Nicholas, right? So I think the last one was, you know, many, many months ago. I'm very happy to be back, you know, on this podcast to discuss with you. And we're kind of taking a novel approach here today. You know, we wanted to have, you know, the FinTech Lab at the National University of Singapore. You know, we want to bring kind of the rigorous academic thinking into, you know, real world practices and real world use cases, real world applications. And we thought, hey, it might be really interesting to kind of bridge the theory practice gap, if you will, bring some novel thinking from academia and discuss those kinds of new ideas that are emerging from the academic literature and bring that to kind of relevant use cases, relevant issues that are, I guess, challenges in today's society. And our team identified a very interesting paper recently published in March 2025 in MIS Quarterly titled Regulating Emerging Technology, Prospective Sensemaking Through Abstraction and Elaboration. This is a paper by Stefan Seidel from the University of Cologne, Christoph Frick from the University of Liechtenstein, and Jan van Brocke from the University of Münster. They're all from Europe, and they're very... It's a case study of how tiny country of Liechtenstein came about to organize, to regulate blockchain. What was your kind of insights on this, Nicholas? Can you just get us started? Like, what are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, I think you did a great job setting it up. Yes, this paper does a good job of understanding through the lens of blockchain regulation, the overall larger problem of as different kinds of technologies are rapidly evolving, whether they be artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, biotechnology, there often is a lag between government regulation and the innovations that are happening in the industrial space. I think this is important for several reasons. The authors do highlight the natural tension between allowing for innovation while still trying to keep the overall regulatory regime up to date in such a way that the public is not harmed, whether through scams or other kinds of inadvertent loopholes that might allow bad actors or just people with blind spots to make mistakes, or people who might have been acting in good faith to inadvertently stumble across future regulatory red lines that they had not been aware of earlier. And so this gray zone, this gray area between allowing for innovation and having smart regulation is what the paper is looking at. And again, in particular, in the development of regulation in blockchain space, in this particular case study in Liechtenstein, they kind of understand the social practices that were involved in setting up the end result legislation that is now heralded as one of the strong early frameworks that will discuss perhaps some of the benefits and challenges that they overcame setting this up and the impact on the wider world.
Thanks for that kind of overview. I think, you know, not just blockchains, which is the target topic of this paper, but regulating blockchain and, you know, regulating blockchains or related kind of use cases. You know, we've seen things like ICOs, we've seen things like cryptocurrencies. There's been major confusion around is a cryptocurrency a security or not? Is it just a token? What does it mean to have tokens? Now what is a token? You know, how do we regulate things like stable coins, for instance? There's been a lot of speculation, there's been a lot of scandal that kind of emerged, and a lot of people, investors, retail investors, and also institutional investors actually got hit pretty hard by these technologies because the technology moves too fast, right? So I think it's good that people are innovating, people are pushing the boundaries, pushing the envelope, creating new technologies that can do new things, create new use cases, create, you know, new functionalities, create new ways of doing things, create new ways of, you know, transacting, create new ways of, you know, holding value in assets, so on and so forth. Or even if we go broader, beyond blockchain technologies, new ways of creating intelligent machines throughout artificial intelligence. But I guess we are realizing that many of these technological developments are kind of coming at us very quickly through distributed kind of open innovation everywhere around the world. And it's very hard to keep up. And, you know, the legislation or regulatory process is just not fast enough to keep up with all the developments, right? So, you know, even if we're thinking about regulating AI or artificial intelligence today, like we know a lot about it already, but we really don't know to the full extent what, for example, AI technology might look like in 3 years or 5 years when we have, for instance, you know, artificial general intelligence or artificial super intelligence, right? And so, you know, how do we create, now, I guess the key fundamental question that I think we should be asking right now and that this paper actually tackles is how do we create regulatory frameworks that are flexible enough to, you know, to encompass future use cases, and the future is uncertain. The future is, you know, we don't know what the future will actually look like. We have some glimpses of the trajectories, but how do we, you know, create regulatory frameworks that ensure safety for, I guess, humanity, safety, yet at the same time doesn't cripple or constrain innovation such that we lose the flexibility of creating novel technologies that actually benefit society, right? So it's a fundamentally very challenging question. Right? We have to try to regulate something that's a moving target. What we know about it is limited and it's evolving. Yet how do we do it? And I guess this case just provides, I think the case of Liechtenstein that's discussed in detail, that's analyzed in detail in this particular paper, provides an interesting perspective, right? There's two tensions here that need to be resolved. One is flexibility. So we want to allow for innovation to continue. But at the same time, we need specificity. Because if we don't have specificity, then we don't really know how to regulate, right? So if we don't name a particular technology, saying, let's say, you know, cryptocurrency, right? And we define what it is and how it should be regulated, how it should be conceptualized, how it should be regulated. If we don't define it, then it's very difficult to regulate after the fact, because if some case actually happens, the courts actually have to decide and interpret. And that interpretation may not have a lot of the consensus underlying in standing by the spirit of the law or the spirit of the regulation when it was actually created. Right. So that level of specificity is also interesting, is also important. And so I guess there's probably two ways in which different jurisdictions have attempted to do this. And it has always been an either or approach, I guess. Right. So it's always been either how would you call it, a technology specific laws or technology neutral laws. Right. So technology neutral laws would be a bit more vague, but encompassing like kind of the definitions, the spirit of what we're trying to regulate, whereas technology specificity or technology specific laws tailor rules to the particular risks of a given innovation. It's either or so far. And I guess what this paper is like highlighting or pointing out is that it doesn't need to be an either or, because you can have balance that trade-off effectively if we follow a principled process. So can you walk me through kind of the Liechtenstein case and how they've been trying to balance this trade-off?
Yes, of course. Yeah. And before I jump into the actual case, I think just to add on one point to one of the points you were making is that this balance between the technology neutrality, or in a sense, the agnosticism towards the technology of how it's actually implemented versus the specificity, is useful not just in the discussion around understanding the spirit of the law and the fact that the judges may or may not interpret that correctly, but also that I think we, in a lot of the discussions that we see with our industry partners and their discussions with policymakers, is that they want to know as well, clear and ahead of time, if they're breaking the law or not. And they don't want to invest millions of dollars only to be hit with fines of millions of dollars by a judge later on because the law was too ambiguous. And so at the same time, they sometimes like ambiguity, because if things are set in stone too early on, while the technology is moving quickly, it will of course tie their hands and prevent rapid iteration and new innovations to occur. And so, as Zhang Po was mentioning, the case of Liechtenstein shows how there's a way that this municipality was able to try to balance these two tensions that perhaps is actually being done by many municipalities. And the authors of this paper discuss that this is done through an iterative process, what they call abstraction and elaboration. But before we kind of talk too much about these two words, we can walk through a little bit of the actual on-the-ground process that Liechtenstein went through when they were developing this technology.
Based on, you know, the description from the case, I guess they had like a three-phased approach, right? Mm-hmm. You know, phase one, what was it called? Closed circle sense making. You know, what does that mean?
Well, I would say that back in 2016, when this hype around Bitcoin was growing and growing, there was a growing number of companies and traditional TradFi startups around crypto, and also legal firms and government agencies who were interested in understanding, as there's a more opportunity here, but also potential for potentially bad actors, scams. Remember, this is around the ICO craze, initial coin offering craze. People wanted to make sure that they were actually following the rules of the road. So way back in 2016, in this closed circle sense-making phase, a group of three different parties, one a cryptocurrency company, one a legal firm, and one a government agency, promoted and kicked off the idea that perhaps Liechtenstein should build some regulatory frameworks around crypto. And this was actually escalated to the prime minister's desk, who put it as a relatively high priority to kick down to lower ministries to say, let's develop a working group with key players from across different perspectives, again, between legal, regulatory, traditional finance, and cryptocurrency innovators, to understand what rules of the road should we really set up. And again, as we discussed in phase one, they began this closed circle sense-making group where they brought together a group of only 10 different parties to really go through several intense meetings with a core working group to explore some of what the basic definitions and understanding of this rapidly emerging technology would be, so that all of the different parties would be able to speak with a common vocabulary about what the technology even was at the time.
So in this phase, so it's a small closed group. Like, how do we pick who to include in that group, right? So it was probably, you know, it was commissioned by the, you know, the government, you know, we picked the right people. But isn't the choice, because it's a small group, you know, I think it's 6 or 10 people in that group. How do we pick the right people, right? So given the technology, you know, if we're trying to regulate blockchain, but at the same time, I guess the main requirement for this initial phase of closed circle sense making was really to, you know, really redefine or better define what we're trying to regulate here, right? So, you know, is it the technology? What is the actual technology, or is it a broader concept? In the Liechtenstein case, I guess the concept of the technology, the conceptualization, kind of evolved from the technology itself, like blockchain, to more to define something they call trustworthy or trusted technologies, right? TT, as was in this case, right? So in order for that kind of broader understanding to emerge, I think finding the right people, bringing the right people to the group is really an important precursor to achieving that. How did that work?
From my understanding, the ability to bring the right people to the table, as again, was kicked off in a relatively cross-disciplinary manner, as I said, between the technological experts, the cryptocurrency experts, the government actors, and legal firms. And you're right, in fact, the core group did initially consist of 6 different firms. And then as we will kind of go into phase two and phase three, a larger number of institutional actors were brought in. From my understanding of the Liechtenstein case, the initial firms that were brought in were a broad group of founders, executives, lawyers, and company employees that would have had on-the-ground expertise. To be honest, I'm not sure exactly how, given the text in the case, the kind of core group was really
selected.
And I think that one of the things that is of interest to us as academics is the understanding of perhaps who was not in the room. I think when you're crafting the legislation, there's potential tendencies for conflicts of interest. There's potential tendencies for people to create kind of legal regimes that are going to make what they're doing, you know, clearly legal, but might create ambiguities for the people who are not present. So I think this question of who was present was perhaps not clearly kind of explained in the case from my point of view. But I think this kind of gradual rollout where they began with the very basic definitions and then roll it out to kind of increasing number of participants to help craft the final legislation was a way to eventually try to make sure that these conflicts of interest didn't occur. But from your reading, did you see more about that?
Not from the reading of the case, but I think it's really important to really understand who's at the table, because there's always some ulterior motive in a bad way. But there's regulation or legislation actually favors some groups over others. It makes it easier for, let's say, companies to do something, or it makes it more difficult for companies to do something, and it protects consumers a bit more, for instance, right? Or it protects, some types of companies, bigger companies versus smaller companies. For example, with AI in the beginning, most of the companies, I guess, like OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, they were against regulation, right? They said, it's going to stifle innovation and we don't want regulation. But nowadays, they are all calling for regulation. Is it really that they are concerned about people's safety and responsible use of AI? Or it could be, because we don't really know, it could be that they're just trying to raise the entry barriers for smaller startups, right? Creating regulatory regimes actually creates a lot of, compliance, I guess, needs and requirements. And it's going to be much more difficult for a small company with, smaller legal teams or without limited resources to be able to actually do, the things that they need to do, right? So when you create regulation, it's really important that those who are at the table aren't really creating a favorable regime that just makes it easier for them to continue to do what they want to do, rather than think about the global optimum, like the maximal social welfare, if you will, right? And so, everybody, every stakeholder has a perspective, has interests, and I don't think that this was kind of discussed at length in this article. And I was assuming in most cases, when we see regulatory discussions, it is really, people with different interests that debate on the merits of whether this will be good or that will be good, like this approach will be good or that approach will be good, right? For example, again, the tension is really whether or not, the tension of flexibility and specificity is really whether we side with the innovators on the company side, on the industry side, and let companies or innovators, industry, give them free rein to innovate, to experiment, to do things that may turn out to be harmful, versus specificity, where we are having a tighter control over what can be done, what cannot be done, to protect the public or consumers. So there are always these different perspectives and conflicts, these different interests at play. But just thinking about who is chosen to be at the table, I think, is a fundamental question that really requires deeper thinking. But anyway, so at the end of the day, I think the Liechtenstein case was, despite not having carefully thought through or not discussed, maybe it was implicitly thought through, but not really having articulated how that choice was made. At least, I guess, at the end of the day, I think they're happy with the regulation in terms of tackling the balancing the trade-off between specificity and flexibility. I guess move on from there and see what else was there. So again, then after that closed circle sense making, they went into phase two, which is extended circle sense making there. So they're opening the doors a little bit and including more perspectives, more additional perspectives, additional stakeholders. So what was phase two really, targeted at? What's the goal of phase two here?
Yeah, of course. So the goal of phase one, again, was purely to understand the ecosystem and deliver a decision about what should be done regarding crypto at a high level. At the end of phase one, they determined that, in fact, it would be good to make a law. And moving to phase two, the idea was we should invite more people beyond the small number that have just sat at the table to define terms and understand the space, to understand what kind of regulation should be in this law. Overall, this phase two, this extended circle sense-making group, again, extended the number of participants from the 6 core members to a slightly larger group of 10, but had roughly the same coverage in terms of expertise, including lawmakers, regulators, and industry participants. Notably, there's also some university academics included in the larger group. And this new working group was tasked with developing the law itself. The larger group consisted of 3 meetings in extended working groups that would have addressed this conceptual development of the initial reports and proposed a law that then could be summarized into form that could be shared with a wider audience. Mm-hmm. I think in particular, one thing that's interesting is that the stakeholders said the ability to have something discussed in a closed meeting was really helpful. In fact, they quote, in the early stage, you cannot discuss something with a large mass of people. In the early stages, it's important to do this in a closed circle of good people, innovative people, and then work it out to the extent that it constitutes a good solution among those people. So I thought that this idea of kind of having something just figured out amongst the close insiders and then kind of farming it out to the wider public or even other members of the industry is something that probably does make sense in reality. Like, it's just easier to get consensus among a smaller group, to get sense making among a smaller group. But of course, it does highlight this kind of tension that we see happen a lot, where if you have kind of backdoor meetings, to what extent, as Joan Pill said, is there potential for any of this to be biased towards the members of the meetings? And what work are they doing to show that it's not? I think at the end of the day, as Joan Pill said, in this regulation, there is nothing to particularly suggest that it is biased or not. But I think that the fact that it is just a little bit more of a closed-door system is perhaps something that is somewhat culturally contingent. If you go into the USA, of course, it's a large place. You might indeed have many closed-door meetings, but there's more of a perhaps demand that there's a lot more of this open decision-making. If you look at regulation at the EU level, you might also see a demand for kind of wider discussions before things get put into law, which sometimes does water down the specificity that would be able to be built in when you have kind of a closed door meeting where people are really committed to understanding a topic in detail and then perhaps elaborating some specific recommendations given their more detailed understanding. So I think that's probably one of the interesting links between process and outcome is looking at having closed door meeting perhaps gives us more specific and elaborated recommendations, or perhaps having a more open door process makes the end results of the regulation be much more open to interpretation and then perhaps clarified by courts down the line.
Yeah. No. So one thing that I found really interesting still in this phase two was that I think the concept of what to regulate actually also shifted. Instead of just focusing on, let's say, crypto finance system, they kind of defined the overall regulatory target as, you know, regulating trustworthy technology-based token economy, which is a much broader concept. You know, the ideas became a lot more general, a lot more abstract, a lot more encompassing of what the technology can do and cannot do. You know, what was that outcome a necessary consequence of this extended circle sense making? Is it because we brought in a broader set of people, broader set of perspectives than the closed circle sense making phase, that they were able to create this broader conceptualization that encompasses overall token economy, like trustworthy technology-based token economy, rather than just trying to regulate like crypto finance? And so is it just correlated? Or was it a, you know, do you think this, you know, the process of extending the circle, the actual intent of extending the circle actually helped to do this? I'm just trying to figure it out. I think yes, but I also think that, you know, it's not a necessary consequence, right? It's not like a deterministic consequence that if we broaden it up, we're naturally going to get this outcome of having a broader, more deeper understanding, a more encompassing overarching framework on what to regulate.
I would say that from my point of view, the extended working group didn't necessarily extend the set of participants, at least within the crypto association and crypto communities, very much. It was mainly extending it towards more legal scholars and university professors. There was no additional crypto people added to it. We do see actually starting in the very beginning of the group membership, what they call a trust company rather than a law firm, which is founded in this case by an owner and lawyer. But I think perhaps having kind of the seed, one of the six initial people in this kind of unique organization that they call a trust company is again, different from a law firm or a crypto company or a bank, perhaps was a bit determinant of the ending language. I think also just to kind of focus on the ending framework, we might also speculate as to if we're going to be discussing the regulations of tokens as distinct from anything to do with decentralized ledger technology or ledgers in general, then perhaps this is something that we might think of, because Liechtenstein is similar to Singapore, a financial hub, there might have been more, perhaps rather than a technological hub, there might have been more people who are interested in saying, how can we use the traditional technology in the banking ecosystem, databases, centralized databases at that, and say, can we still have tokens being held at banks? Can you have a bank be a custodian of some of your goods, and then this digital representation of a good be transferred to bank to bank, while kind of leaving aside the question of whether or not this token is represented on a distributed ledger like Ethereum, or even a centralized ledger like a proof of authority chain, because you can't have tokens in some sense, just representations of digital goods, just held in databases if the bank prefers to do it that way. And I think this was, to a degree, the end outcome of the legislation that was produced. And if we tie it back to this question that Junko had about whether or not the number of people in the room, kind of having a co-working group moving towards an extended working group, is what resulted in the shift from the language around traditionally used terms such as Web3 or decentralized ledger technology towards novel legal terms such as trusted technology. I do think that paper does discuss what they call this iterative process of abstraction and then elaboration. So I think they might have lots of specifics of moving pieces of crypto ICOs, coin offerings, understanding of the technology that they then try to elaborate into an abstraction that gives a general description of what's going on. And once they have this general understanding, they perhaps see new specific things that they want to regulate or shift the understanding of what language is even useful to use. One final point I'll make before handing it back to Junko. In my own research of this space, I saw that there was quite an interesting gap, in a sense, between legal experts in the crypto space and technology experts. And the language the technology experts would use would often be much more focused on perhaps matters of trust, but in a purely technological kind of distributed systems way, whereas legal experts had a much more kind of human understanding of what might people try to do to break the rules, how might these things be used by businesses. And the bridging of this gap often would necessitate completely new language. And I think the language that is dominant in the space, including probably up till now, is the language of the technologist, the language of perhaps the economist, and not quite the language of the legal expert, perhaps with a few caveats such as securities law that, of course, can create existential problems for all sorts of companies. The legal expert's point of view are not deeply embedded into the discourse around crypto before these kinds of closed door and even extended working group sessions have been put into place.
No, I think you bring up a really interesting point, like the case where, you know, people speak different languages, right? The legal professionals versus the technologists speak about the same thing in very different ways, right? And so there's a disconnect, a communication gap, if you will. Now, is that, and I'm just trying to see whether or not the gap itself is a level gap versus a type gap. Like, what I mean by that is a type gap might be different domains. I speak, you know, this language, you speak another, you know, you're focused on different sets of things, and there's no kind of overlap, right? Not a whole lot of consensus, common ground to have a meaningful discussion. A gap in level could be one is very abstract, one is very detailed or more specific, right? So the legal perspective might be very abstract, and the technologist perspective might be very detailed and specific, but bridging that gap might be, you know, the critical challenge, right? So I think, as the paper points out, they're proposing or the proponents of this process of abstraction and elaboration, which is basically abstraction is zooming out, elaboration is zooming in, and you want to not just, you know, just do it once, but like iteratively zoom out, zoom in, zoom out, zoom in, zoom out, zoom in, so that you're able to capture a broader perspective and then drill it down into a specific set of, like, how do we want to regulate this particular case that we've been able to abstract into a more generalized kind of principle. Now, if that's the case, I guess the main question is, how do we create the right vocabulary, if you will, or the right communication approach, such that, you know, we have a mapping from the higher level, you know, abstract legal principles about safety, privacy, about, you know, efficiency, about trustworthiness, all these more human or societal principles, and how that translates into the technologist's specific language. Could be things like tamper-proofness, things like that from the blockchain. It could be, you know, like guaranteed proofs from zero-knowledge proof systems, so on and so forth. But how that actually translates into the broader principle of, you know, the human principles or the societal principles. I don't think that that mapping, we have a lot of communication gaps there, right? I don't think we have a clear mapping, at least at this stage. You know, you and I being kind of in that space, being information systems kind of academic, puts us in that, I guess, more privileged position of being able to understand the technology as well as understand, you know, being social technical people or focused, social technically focused academics. It gives us that positioning within that ecosystem. But at the same time, I don't think I'm able to, you know, I'm confident to be able to translate all of the technical specificities into and map it to, you know, the broader higher level principles of what's desired in society, right? So I think this idea, this framework that the authors propose of the abstraction and elaboration is very important, right? And whether or not that will succeed, I think really depends on, you know, how well we can bridge that communication gap or that conceptualization gap. What we think about when we say, for example, like privacy or security, what that actually means from a technologist perspective versus what that means for a regulatory perspective could be very different. And bridging that gap, and I guess what they're, you know, these authors are kind of proposing is that if you go through a process, iterative process of abstraction and elaboration, this will naturally happen. You know, I would like to believe that, but I'm also a huge skeptic. If it's like a cookbook, if you follow a cookbook and you follow the recipe, at the end you will have that dish, right? Is this really a cookbook, or is it, you know, is there a lot to rely on kind of faith? Yes, it has kind of the properties that would, you know, the process of abstraction and elaboration iteratively does allow, creates a better foundation for this, the communication gap to be resolved, I suppose, but it's not a guaranteed outcome. So you know, how do we think about, you know, whether or not this kind of framework, how useful this kind of framework is? I guess it is useful. It's good to think about, I guess, from an implication perspective, right? What are the implications? I think it's, you know, what regulators or people participating in these regulatory processes, discussions, should really have in the back of their mind in terms of goals for how to, you know, debate and make arguments in these proceedings, and then hoping for the best. I don't know. What's your take on that?
I think that this question of if the elaboration and, you know, abstraction, this zooming out and zooming in iteration is happening naturally or perhaps needs to be helped along is a good one. And I think also the case of Liechtenstein example is interesting in that in each of the phases that they went through, there's actually a relatively small number of meetings. I think it's perhaps some of the meetings were, you know, multi-hour long, but I think for example, the first phase was perhaps five meetings, which might feel like a lot, but if you're, you know, proposing the legislation for an entire country, seems relatively quick. From my point of view, I think one of the things that you brought up is that, is there a difference, let's say, between the technologists and the legal scholars or lawyers? That is this a difference of type or of specificity? One of the points you brought up earlier was whether or not there was a difference between the technologists and the legal scholars of level, as you called it, kind of making general points versus specific points, or whether it was a matter of, as you called it, of type, of having perhaps a Venn diagram of things they were concerned about that may or may not be fully overlapping. From my prior research on this, it's more of a matter of type, where of course, the technologists, in some sense, are much more zoomed in on, of course, how the code runs and on perhaps mathematical proofs, but they have a very loose understanding, a very kind of not very fine-grained understanding of the concept of trust, which is something that legal scholars, is a human concept, is an organizational concept, is a business concept, the legal scholars or lawyers just in general will have much, much more experience and kind of historical memory built into, whereas from a computer scientist point of view or even economist point of view, they might purely look at it from the point of view of game theory or, you know, hacking into distributed systems, which is a rather one-dimensional way to understand trust compared to the legal scholars. And I think putting them in conversation, from what I've seen, creates a lot of really good blind spot clarification, especially for the technologists. One thing that you brought up is, how do we translate some of the kind of societal level issues and bring them to technologists? I really do think that it probably is much easier, in fact, to take a legal scholar and train them in the basics of what is going on in the technology, have technologists explain to them the high level moving pieces, and then have them understand, A, what are the kind of altruistic things that we all wish society will go towards, but also B, what are the human kind of frailties or the human kind of aggressions or conflicts of interest or problems that have cropped up historically that technologists, I think, are not as aware of. I think perhaps within the crypto space, we do have a large number of finance people who slightly on the technologist side speak mathematically, speak with some historical knowledge of scams that have happened in the past. And so putting these people together is useful. Going back to the case study, I think it's interesting to see from my point of view that moving from this phase two, where they adjusted the language away from, you know, decentralized ledger technology towards trusted technology, which essentially focused on tokens, and then moving on to phase three, opened it up to a little bit more of a parliamentarian discussion within Liechtenstein. There doesn't seem to have been much rewriting of the policy between these two phases. And so perhaps this is showing up a little bit of the fact that when you do have legal scholars in the room, they are able to capture kind of the zeitgeist of what matters to the public, hopefully will make things legally kosher and societally acceptable. And of course, in the fact that they're doing this in close conversation with technologists, what they are saying is also timely and not tying the hands of further innovation.
Yeah. So this phase three was, they called it regulatory implementation. And again, to distinguish, differentiate between what they did in phase one and two, closed circle, then extended circle, sense making, and then this final stage of regulatory implementation where they actually opened it up further, included proper public consultation processes where anyone could submit feedback. So that was kind of more the political process, right, of the legislation kind of gaining legitimacy and acceptance, right? I think there's kind of two things happening here. One is the process leading towards convergence is one thing, closed circle, extended circle, gaining more buy-in, and then regulatory implementation where they have public consultations and getting full buy-in, broader buy-in. And that's one process. But the I guess the goal of the regulatory process is actually to create the right regulation, not just accept and enact a regulation or legislation. It's not to accept a particular one or just one, but to find the right one. And, you know, finding the right one that balances specificity and flexibility, right? Which was kind of the original objective of, you know, the biggest challenge, the problem statement here. I'm not sure I follow why the acceptance process, again, it's important. The necessary condition is we find the right, you know, way to regulate, and then making sure that it actually gets through. That's a different question, but it's also very important. That's a process question. But the substance question is, how do we know we find the right way to regulate? And is this the right way to regulate? I think it's an interesting way compared to the status quo, where it was just, you know, we start off with, hey, how do we, you know, regulate blockchains and cryptos and ICOs and, you know, just tokens, to how do we think about trusted technologies for, you know, a token-based economy is a broader, more interesting concept. But that's only because maybe the initial conceptualization was very limited and technology focused, focusing too much on specificity rather than on the flexibility aspects of it, right? So it was anchored more on specificity and we moved towards more flexibility. But it could have been the other way around as well. The AI Act is kind of going the opposite direction, where we have broad principles like the EU AI Act. As broad principles like, you know, the, you know, fairness, accountability, ethics, transparency, explainability, all these high level principles, but there's no way to specifically articulate how these principles actually are get enacted or are regulated actually in practice. So it's very vague. Like the EU AI Act has things like risk levels, and for high risk versus low risk or medium risk, here's what you're kind of required for the technology to have. For instance, you must have human in the loop for high risk AI applications, or you must have explainable AI. And explainable AI is also defined very vaguely in terms of you must provide reasonable explanations. How do you set the bar for what's reasonable versus unreasonable? And so it's very vague. And companies, how do I know if I'm in a low risk or a mid risk or a high risk situation? And without that specificity, it's very difficult to move forward because you don't know after the fact. The courts might rule that, hey, you thought you were low risk, but you're actually mid risk, and you are put to a higher standard in terms of all these regulatory requirements. And that just doesn't help firms innovate. But again, going back to the original question, I think there's two parts. One is finding the right way to regulate. Right? It's not whether or not, but how to regulate. I think that's the key question. Having a process that allows you to, once you find a regulation or the right regulation, having the right process to actually enact it, adopt it, and implement it, that's a nice to have. But that's like a secondary question, I feel. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think your discussion of the level of ambiguity, the level of things kind of being done in a closed door manner and then brought to open door manner, I think my thoughts on that is perhaps it's just due to the rapid rise of social media, but it does feel like a lot of things are happening at a much faster pace these days. And I think many people would say that. And in line with this, we see kind of a rapid rise of, in a sense, the questioning of the democratic process in general in many countries. And I think the tendency towards doing things at a more in a more closed door manner. Sometimes this is called a consultative manner, where the people in the government do consult with the main stakeholders, be they businesses, law firms, or what have you, and then basically roll out a legislation that perhaps is clear, but moves quicker than the typical back and forth process that we might expect. As the world is moving quicker, I do suspect we might see more of that. Or we also might see, I think even if things are kind of left clear and ambiguous and kept within the typical kind of slow democratic process, even within this realm, if we compare USA and EU at large, I think there's two different ways of keeping things ambiguous. I think the typical, what we are typically seeing in the USA is, as you said, incumbents, whether it be in AI or crypto, often ask and sometimes are allowed a lot of legal ambiguity. And then once enough bad things have happened, then, stop signs are put into place. Or once, as you said, some certain firms get big enough, they lobby essentially to get regulatory moats to prevent newcomers from disrupting them, which has, is mixed blessings. Whereas on the EU side, we perhaps see still a lot of ambiguity. At the end of the day, having this ambiguity allow certain players to emerge and then perhaps bend the process towards favoring them, it seems to be a little bit of a stifling of players in general, because the ambiguity does lead to rather high levels of kind of financial risk for any company that's going to be playing in the EU space. And then we see smaller jurisdictions, be they Singapore, be they Liechtenstein, or even particular states within the USA, setting up kind of more tailor-made regulations that end up being the places that firms end up being headquartered. So Switzerland as well, Cayman Islands, Delaware, Wyoming, UAE, these kind of smaller countries, we do see these tend to be the places that firms will kind of place themselves to have a friendly and stable legal environment. And perhaps in these smaller places, there's more of incentive to make sure that this process is done in a clear and consultative manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think, again, it's a very challenging problem. And I guess, moving the needle slightly even is very welcome in this huge uncertainty. Being able to maybe not have, a deterministic, optimal answer, right? Which I think is at this stage, given all the uncertainty and we don't know the future, is impossible to attain. But at least this approach, I guess, this kind of thinking, this thought process about how do we actually try to get at slightly better understanding of what we are regulating and how to regulate in terms of this iterative process of abstraction and elaboration, I think is a welcome kind of conceptual toolkit that may be used. Again, you know, I'm more of a like a optimization kind of person, I guess. But I would like to see something that gives us the correct answer. But I guess it's also a bit premature to even think that a correct answer to this problem is actually feasible. And so I think it's important to recognize that, yes, this is a challenge, and we need different conceptual frameworks or ideas, approaches that allow us to, you know, not repeat mistakes from the past, or I'm not sure if we want to call them mistakes, but like have premature or, you know, regulation or different ways of regulating that are too narrowly focused or too inflexible or too, you know, too vague to be effective regulations, right? And so I think this is, in that sense, I think it's useful, helps us think through the process a little better and likely gives us at least a more nuanced and disciplined or well thought through outcome than if it didn't happen. That's a welcome addition to our conceptual toolkit. And we're kind of running out of time, so to wrap up a little in a bit, but let's talk about, try to apply this with the elephant in the room, which is kind of AI right now. Okay, blockchain, very important. Maybe when they were doing the study back in, you know, 2016 and so on, AI wasn't the big topic of the day, but now AI is a big topic. Do you see this approach helping with, let's say, AI regulation?
I think that of course, kind of, as we talked about, having kind of an iteration between hopefully legal scholars who are not just purely looking at the liability side, but also being able to articulate things in a sense of what seems fair, as well as what kind of scams people might try to pull or kind of violations of normal trust people might try to create in conversation with real builders who are actually kind of on the ground saying, here's what we want to do. If we look at the example of Facebook, formerly Facebook, now known as Meta, has been revealed that when they were training their model, they were pirating lots of books to get the training data for their model, which is, you know, a clearly illegal act to do. And so, but they might say, you know, that the general welfare in some economic or legal or, you know, societal sense could be said to allow for a violation of our traditional kind of understanding of what is right and what is wrong. So I think if we're kind of going to be using the toolkit here to understand how AI will be unrolled, I do think that having more open discussion amongst people in different domains and actually coming up with a shared kind of understanding instead of having it be endlessly antagonistic or endlessly kind of self-promoting of one company or another would be useful. I think another thing that we do see in this case that we might be seeing in AI as well is, again, this was a very, what we call consultative process, where the government kind of initiated a closed door meeting between some industry players and government players and basically tailored the law to say, here's what we think it should be, and then rolled it out to the public. I do think that this is, as I was saying before, something that can both be very beneficial to kind of help create the emergence of big players in the market and then create certain, in a sense, moats to help them kind of remain profitable. And we've seen this kind of in the wider, if we look just not in the past decade, but to the kind of past century, what we think of as Asian tiger economies, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, even China to an extent, and even America, if you look at the military industrial complex, there was a partnering between the government and core industries that both helped these industries boom, maybe helped the economy and the GDP of these countries grow much more rapidly than people who are purely hands-off and free market, but also instituted a lot of potential corruption when you have government agencies kind of sitting down and having dinner regularly with kind of so-called, you know, key players in the industry. And so I think this is, when we look at AI, I'm sure we're seeing something similar emerge where you have kind of some mega players emerging, whether it be OpenAI, Meta, Google, and a potential of regulatory capture. And I think the process laid out in this paper of saying, oh, you know, it's good because the government and the lawyers and the companies all sit down, in a way, they will create elaborate laws that are also general enough. I think this is generally good. And as I said, we might see actually quite good legislation come out of this, but we still have to be prepared for the risk that, as we said at the kind of beginning of this show, that the regulatory rules that get put into place might end up favoring the incumbents much more at the expense of the up-and-comers. And within the crypto regime, as we've seen in the USA, People have been accusing the kind of the Biden era regulators of being perhaps unfairly litigious or placing undue pressure on kind of up and coming technologies, perhaps because of their regulatory capture of traditional finance. So I think we shouldn't be too rosy with this kind of, oh, you know, elaboration and abstraction process will always lead to good results. Although it can in many cases, we just need to understand the silver linings and the dark clouds that go along with them.
I think AI is very interesting, and it's kind of unique, where it's not just because the technology itself, because it is, I guess, championed from industry. It's not a distributed open source technology like blockchain or the distributed ledger technologies, where anyone can adopt it. But you know, because those superpowers in AI are concentrated in, let's say, the USA or China, that it creates a lot of these geopolitical kind of tensions and risks where, you know, adopting AI versus building AI for your own country. A lot of countries, all of the other countries except for China and maybe US, now they have to think about what kind of AI are we actually developing and using? Are we going to use open AIs and just use their APIs to create our own AI, or just use the plain vanilla version of that? And I think there's a lot of these discussions going on, a lot of these challenges because of these geopolitical issues that are kind of in the background as well. There's a lot of security issues, national security issues, their desires, countries' desires to maintain AI free from kind of political kind of intervention or manipulation. And decoupling that is very important, but I don't think people have trust in that right now as of this day. I think one of the interesting things that I've observed, at least, is that everybody is kind of a wait and see mode. Let's see what EU has done AI Act, but they're also trying to like regroup and redo it, I guess, make it more specific in some senses, more general in some other senses, but kind of rearticulate the AI Act. The US is still doing its laissez-faire, like innovation first approach. And a lot of other nations are just saying, okay, we're not going to do hard regulation. We're going to do soft regulation through guidelines and like best practices and things like that. And again, that, you know, it helps, but it doesn't provide clarity, right? Because at any point in time, you can say, well, yeah, we're going to start regulating it this way, and whatever you've been doing so far might be moot. And so this laissez-faire approach, the wait-and-see approach, I think is quite interesting. But at the same time, it's also just delaying the inevitable. Perhaps, you know, this kind of thinking of elaboration and abstraction, iteratively thinking through and creating regulation might actually help to at least create the right level of regulation that might be useful. And again, whether or not these, you know, the regulation that you actually end up with is actually useful is really an empirical question, I think. We don't know whether or not it will be because of an uncertain future. And we have to see whether or not the regulations that have been the result are actually future-proof, right? Mm-hmm. That's an empirical question. I don't think we have the data or kind of the concepts or the models to be able to assess whether or not a particular regulation has been useful or not. Again, in terms of just doing a case, I think it's interesting. But if we were to, let's say, analyze different regulatory approaches across, you know, for the same technology, let's say blockchain or AI, and think about how that actually changes society, the GDP from an economic perspective, or the amount of investments, the startup ecosystem, the energy, you know, whatever, you know, I'll try to measure all these changes based on that are relevant to that particular technology, and see and try to assess what are the impacts of, you know, different specificity versus flexibility, levels of flexibility and specificity of regulation, and how that kind of actually has an impact on, you know, more macro societal level metrics. I think that would be a very interesting study to do, right? Mm-hmm. Because this case showed us like this is the right approach, but we needed an assessment of whether or not it's actually doing what it's supposed to do, right? So I think that's, you know, it's a very, very interesting avenue for future research. And I hope somebody tackles that. If I know.
I think for me, if I could name one thing I wish the paper would have perhaps included a little bit more discussion of, would be how the stakeholders elaborated their understanding of the different risks, and then how around the technology, and then how did these this understanding of the risks get put into the legislation? As far as I understand it, you know, in crypto, there's many types of risks. There's scams, there's fraud, there's cyber attacks that end up with millions of dollars stolen, and so you have some questions around, you know, who's responsible if their money is stolen or you're transacting and some of the money gets taken along the way, or there's all sorts of attacks. There's sandwich attacks that essentially people manipulate the exchange rate when you're changing money. So there's all these questions of, you know, problems, and it was not clearly described. And I think when you're talking about regulation in general, of course, you want societally beneficial outcomes, but you want to understand what kind of bad actors are going to be in play. And in crypto, I think there was a very early understanding that there are going to be bad actors because it's anonymous. You know, one of the early iterations of it was very anonymous. You're not going to trust anybody. And in that case, you've always, and they use a lot of game theory, which in which people are profit maximizing. So you have to understand these adversarial systems. I think within AI, we've also had a lot of discussion within the AI safety discourse for over a decade now around, you know, what are all of the kind of potentially kind of sci-fi problems that could go wrong with AI? And I think we're actually seeing some of them play out in real time with, you know, maybe one case is people kind of forming parasocial relationships with their AI. You know, this movie Her came out where someone falls in love with their phone. And then in fact, we do see cases where people fall in love with their AI apps. I do think that, and even OpenAI itself famously kind of fundraised off of saying, you know, we're going to be understanding some of these AI safety discussions, but then very quickly after they gained money, they pivoted away towards being more of a pro, you know, for-profit model. And even when I was in discussion with some people from OpenAI about their kind of AI governance efforts, they kind of discussed how, of course, there was a lot of resources being put towards understanding, you know, the fact that we're not trying to make a rogue agent, but a lot of the kind of oxygen in the room quickly, as you said, got taken up by the geopolitical angle. Governance was focused much less on how do you make sure the AI does what we want it to do and doesn't have bad societal outcomes, which then maybe academics are talking about, and much more about how do we, you know, what if our enemies get this and how do we perhaps respond to adversarial behaviors to bad actors. And I think it's good that these conversations are happening, but I wish that they would happen if they are happening behind closed doors. I do perhaps wish that there was some more ability to create open consensus as well, or at least communicate to the wider audience, you know, that this is really the way it should be and not have it be done in a purely kind of profit maximizing mode. Of course, companies want to profit maximize, but as the regulations unroll, it would be great for us to understand how they're thinking through the different risks and doing this kind of forward thinking risk analysis and when they're crafting the legislation. I think that's something that would be interesting research to see.
No, I agree with you. And you know, there are a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of challenges. And I think, you know, we need to actually discuss these things and focus on these things, study these things and have, you know, at least better understanding of how these things work. And so that we can create a better, like more safe, responsible technology future, right? So I think we're running out of time. So I think we'll call it a day and you know, we'll you know, promise to come back, you know, not too far into the future, sooner than this hiatus that we've experienced. Just also wanted to just plug the 2025 University Blockchain Research Initiative meeting, the UBRI Connect, will be held in Singapore at NUS. And so in June 10th, and then APEX will be right soon after that in Singapore. So if you are planning on attending, please do drop by, give us say hi, and we can talk more about some of these issues. So thank you. See you next time.